I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. In the last year, the relationship between Cuba and the United States has undergone a dramatic transformation. President Obama announced a new course at the beginning of the year after revealing that the two countries had been talking with each other. This past summer, they reopened their embassies, followed by more easing of restrictions, including travel. Well, that got us thinking about taking a trip to Cuba and what the increase in tourism could mean for that island nation. And we asked Christopher Baker to join us. He's a travel journalist specializing in Cuba. He's written a number of books about Cuba, including Moon Cuba. He also writes a National Geographic Traveler Cuba guidebooks. He currently spends about 7 months a year in Cuba. He leads people-to-people trips for U.S. citizens, and he has partnered most recently with actor and producer David Soul on a documentary about the restoration in Cuba of Ernest Hemingway's recently discovered 1955 Chrysler New Yorker. And Christopher Baker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's a delight to be with you.
Very nice to have you with us. You have a British accent, which tells us that it's probably easier for you to have gone to Cuba over these last couple of years.
No, not at all. I live in the States, and that means I'm under U.S. law. I have been going as a journalist and for professional research.
In fact, your first trip was, what, about 20 years ago?
It was more than that. It was 1992, yes.
And what was your reason for that very first trip?
I was authoring a travel guidebook to Jamaica at the time when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was the moment that Cuba began to promote tourism. There was essentially no tourism prior to that. They didn't need it with the Soviet Union's backing. And so when they opened up from Jamaica, it was fairly easy to go in because there were people who were offering excursions from Jamaica. And I fell in love with the place and decided it was time to write my own travel guidebook to Cuba.
What did you fall in love with?
Well, firstly, it's and certainly back then in the 90s when things were pretty grim for Cuba, the no oil, et cetera, no electricity at night, it was the first time I felt that traveling, I'd stepped kind of into a romantic novel, almost a surreal destination. It's only 90 miles, as we know, from U.S. shores, but you're leaving the McDonald's and malls of Miami, et cetera, behind. And you're very much stepping back into a time warp. It's a Hollywood stage set. Havana is virtually unchanged in so many ways from the 1950s. So the urban cityscape is a 1950s time warp. And then when you leave Havana and go into the countryside, there are still oxen plowing the fields, etc. So it's another time warp element also.
And is that true today?
It's still very, very true. In fact, one of the books that I did in ensuing years is a coffee table book about the old American cars, and about one in five of the passenger cars in Cuba predates the revolution.
Which is really incredible when you think about it. I also know that you took a motorcycle trip. This was in the mid-90s for 3 months in Cuba. I think you covered probably every spot in that country, about a 7,000-mile trip.
Well, I did cover everywhere because I used the motorcycle as my vehicle for researching my first guidebook. That was the Moon Cuba guidebook, which was released in its sixth edition this year.
Wow. What do you think, then, this thaw, it will mean for Cuba itself?
It's very important to remember that one of the rationales for Obama's opening to Cuba this way is to support private enterprise in Cuba. This is critical because since Raul Castro took over the presidency of Cuba in 2006, well, beginning in 2011, he's initiated what for Cuba is far-reaching economic reform, and they are sponsoring private enterprise. It's limited. There are 206 categories, but it does mean that private enterprise has begun in Cuba in a communist nation. And so the purpose of travel, at least from the Obama perspective, is to support the nascent private enterprise and hope that that can become a tool for promoting greater democracy. In terms of what it means for Cubans themselves, it clearly means more money in their hands. And so, for example, this year, with the they've not lifted the travel restrictions, and we can get to that in a short while.
Yes.
But they have made it easier to travel, and there's been a 54% increase this year in travel to Cuba by U.S. citizens. They are leaving their dollars behind. They're, for the most part, leaving their dollars in the hands of Cubans themselves, who are able to invest in their businesses, buy more things that were denied them before simply by virtue of them not having the monetary means to purchase.
Are you concerned that the Cuba of yesterday, and it sounds like today as well, the kind of 1950s perhaps movie set look of Cuba, that will become Americanized, or that will somehow change with the influx of American dollars and tourists and business opportunities?
Well, that's certainly a great question. Concerned is not the right word. It is certainly going to happen, because I think the way that the tourist, let's not say tourist, let's say traveler who arrives in Cuba views Cuba in terms of what they really appreciate is, of course, partly this time warp setting that you cannot repeat anywhere else in the world. But do we want the Cubans themselves to be kind of trapped in that scenario? Of course not. We wish the very best for them. One of my concerns that I do have is that one of the marvelous things of the Cuban society, it really very much is a product of 5 decades of communism, where they've tried to create what from their perspective is a better society, because there was extreme poverty and differentials of income before the revolution. What I sense and fear potentially being lost is the sense of community, that we're all serving each other in favor of the me, me, me. So I am beginning to see a materialism already appearing in Cuba, as so many more people now have the means to buy their iPhones, their cell phones, etc. That's the first thing they want. Why should we deny them that right, of course? And Cuba, yes, inevitably is going to change, but the architecture is still there. The old cars are going to be there for a while. And in fact, just to close the comment there, it's very fascinating that the old cars, many of them, at least those that have the potential to be used to take tourists or travelers around on taxis, are actually looking better than they ever were, because for the first time, with many of the restrictions that have been lifted by Obama, Cubans themselves now have access to something they never had access to before. That's real car paint and real parts for repairing their cars.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christopher Baker. He's a travel journalist, and he specializes in Cuba. And we're talking about travel to Cuba, and you can join the conversation. Any question or comments you might have, 1-888-477-9499. You think I'd know that number. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Christopher, I noticed there are still, you know, very specific categories of travel to Cuba. And you have to, I guess, check one in order to get permission to go there: family visits, journalistic activities, professional research, educational activities. How hard and fast are these categories?
Things have eased up considerably this year. So the law says that there are only these 12 categories of individuals who are licensed to travel to Cuba. So tourism is not permitted. You can't just fly on a plane and go and lie on the beach. But what has eased is that all these 12 categories, journalists, etc., now are in essence pre-approved. Until earlier this year, you would have had to request, literally write to the Treasury Department and request a written license to have permission to go to Cuba and trade with Cuba. That's no longer the case. So if you believe that you are a journalist, you simply are pre-approved to go. And as you suggest, Marty, all that you need do is, let's say when you book your airfare, is check a box certifying that you do meet the legal requirements in the category that you say you fulfill.
And are these categories just for Americans visiting Cuba, or is it true for, let's say, Canadians that want to visit that country?
No, this is U.S. law. So everybody else in the world has been free to travel to Cuba forever. Cuba itself has absolutely no restrictions on visitation from anywhere in the world. So this is U.S. law. It comes under the Trading with the Enemy Act. I mean, it's interesting that Obama has gone almost as far as he is legally capable to do to ease the restrictions on travel, but only Congress can actually lift the travel restrictions, because they come under the Trading with the Enemy Act. which she means, was formerly part of that.
Which means no lollygagging on the beach, right?
That's exactly right. And indeed, if you feel you fulfill one of these 12 categories and you fly off to Cuba, you are legally required to maintain what is, and I'll put this in inverted commas, it's a quote, maintain a full schedule of activities related to the category of the 12 categories that you've said you were traveling under.
And are there minders to make sure you're doing what you said you're doing?
No. It has run hot and cold. Certainly under the last Bush administration, they really did begin to chase down people that they'd identified as having traveled to Cuba illegally, and they began to fine quite a few people. That has eased off to the point that, to my knowledge, nobody since 2011 has been prosecuted for illegal travel to Cuba. So in essence, they really have stopped policing this. However, many travel companies that are offering programs, they're certainly under the watch, because there are various different laws that come into play here. And it would certainly be a foolish entity that breaks the law very purposefully, because there are still consequences.
And if someone, let's say, they have a week in Cuba, where do you suggest they go?
Well, let's firstly say how any U.S. citizen can go, because this is very important. So one of the 12 categories is a new category that was recreated in 2011. It's called the People-to-People Educational Exchange category, and it is the only one that every U.S. citizen tomorrow can go to Cuba under. The thing about the People-to-People is it's not for individuals. It is for entities. So I escort tours to Cuba, or travel programs under the People-to-People license for National Geographic Expeditions. I do motorcycling tours under that license also. And anybody can sign up for those programs. So now to answer your question, if the average Joe who signs on for a People-to-People license or trip, let's say it's National Geographic, let's just pick that one.
Sure.
Then you would you'd want to do Havana, you'd probably want to go to Tobacco Country, you'd want to go to the colonial city of Trinidad, and that pretty much, that because Cuba is a very large island, would take up the better part of 10 days. That would be the three hot places that you could easily do in a 10-day trip.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Christopher Baker, a travel journalist. He specializes in Cuba. He's been to that country many, many times. He's also written books about it and guidebooks for National Geographic Traveler. And with all the easing of restrictions, it got us thinking about travel to Cuba, what it takes to get there, how things may or may not have changed. And again, you can join the conversation. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. Much more after this very short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Christopher Baker about travel to Cuba, how to get there, what to do when you get there. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Christopher, we had an email from Mike. He has a question about all those old American cars from the 1950s. Are there also Japanese cars and cars from other countries that might be more current and up to date?
Yeah, absolutely. The state has been importing vehicles ever since the revolution, and which what that means, of course, is that you had three decades of Soviet cars coming in. The most numerous vehicle that you see there is the Soviet-built Lada. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they had to turn to Japan, etc. And so you have a lot of European cars. The French are well represented, Peugeots and Renault, and Japanese. You don't find many Hondas, but you find a lot of Mitsubishis, etc. Most of the car rental fleet, and they do have a large number of cars in the car rental fleet, they're mostly Japanese. Some Audis, you see Mercedes, etc. And I was speaking earlier about the private businesses. You do have some Cubans who are quite wealthy now. So many artists who've become world-renowned, some of them are certainly millionaires, musicians who sell their music and keep their royalties. You see these people driving around in brand-new Audis and sports cars.
Where do you stay? And I was actually reading, Airbnb has opened up in Cuba. What are the options that people have?
Well, in fact, thank goodness for Airbnb in a sense, because there is so much demand now in Cuba. I said that 54% increase in U.S. travel alone this year, that the hotels are sold out.
Really?
It is very difficult to find a hotel room for the next year in Havana. And so you have private room rentals, which are licensed and legal, and Airbnb is one of the entities that makes it possible to stay with families. And when I am not leading groups, when I'm traveling alone, I don't stay in hotels. Why would I stay in a hotel? I can stay with a Cuban family. I can learn firsthand about what life is really like for Cubans, and there's a wide spectrum of experiences, and of course it's very enjoyable. And one of the wonderful things I love about Cuba is that Cubans love to have you in their homes, and you become almost like family. There are two individuals, or two families I should say, in Cuba that I stay with when I'm there, and I do refer them to them as my family. We feel that we've gone beyond friendship level.
And what about eating? What are the options?
Well, this is a fascinating moment because Cuba is undergoing a culinary revolution. Had you asked me that question as recently as 5 or certainly 10 years ago, I would have said, take some Snicker bars or granola bars with you because it's going to be relatively boring. And that is certainly no longer the case. All the limitations on private restaurants have been lifted, and this is where the big money is being invested in private businesses. So you have, certainly you're in for a big surprise in Havana. They've got some world-class private restaurants these days. And I'm talking world-class in terms of their decor, the money invested in preparing tremendous ambience. But also you've got this culinary revolution. As Cuba has been closed off for much of the rest of the world for so long, the state running all the restaurants, etc., the state is pulling out of the restaurant business entirely. And so you have foreign influence. You have foreigners marrying Cubans, foreigners, most, we're talking Europeans, Canadians here, investing in Cuba with private individuals, and they're bringing their international know-how in terms of cuisine. So you're seeing a more international, well, I'll call it a nouvelle Cuban cuisine that's evolving. And so you can dine very, very well these days in Cuba.
That sounds terrific. What about currency? Can you use credit cards in Cuba?
That's a little awkward because this year the restrictions were lifted on American financial institutions using doing big deals with Cuba. There are some limits, but credit card companies have been made legal for them to do business with Cuba. However, the infrastructural networks don't seem to have caught up with that. It is taking a while for them to get their act together, for want of a better word. And so I have yet to be informed by anybody that the U.S. issued credit cards are currently operating in Cuba.
How about dollars?
You really got to go cash only at this stage. If you have a foreign Visa or MasterCard, you're fine. A British European bank, that's fine, as long as it's not processed through a U.S. financial institution. So for Americans, it really means you have to take cash. However, here's a catch. There's obviously a percentage that is paid on currency conversion in Cuba, as there is in any country in the world. For all currencies except the U.S. dollar, it's 3%. For the U.S. dollar, there is an extra 10% surcharge. So it behooves you to obtain euros or Canadian dollars, as I did yesterday from my bank at no cost, because I'm going into Cuba again in 2 days' time. And there you just pay your 3% commission in an exchange. Marty, do we have time to make one other comment?
That's please do, yes.
Regarding money, because there are two different currencies in Cuba. In the USA, we have the U.S. dollar, and Canada has the Canadian dollar. In Cuba, you have the Cuban peso, which is the currency that most Cubans are paid in, and you have a second currency called the convertible peso. And that is what all transactions of any worth, be it in for travelers or even Cubans, are transacted in the two. So it does get complicated. It leads to some potential scams. So it's a great interest. And Cuba is trying to unify the currency, but when they created a second currency, they opened the Pandora's box in terms of economic problems.
And what about those people that just cannot live without their cell phone? Is there a good internet connection in Cuba?
No, there's certainly not a good internet connection. And there's less saturation, internet saturation, than any other country. Certainly in the Americas, and even in the world, it's very low. However, it is improving rapidly. So we have to remember this very, very important point. Cuba has been operating with the U.S. embargo for six decades. The U.S. embargo has prevented Cuba from having access not only to any American satellite systems, but because of U.S. law, to any international telephone systems that have more than 10% of American-produced product involved, industrial products, satellites, etc. So they simply not have access to the broadband. That's beginning to change. Of course, this year Obama legalized telecommunications companies doing deals with Cuba. Verizon and Sprint have both signed deals with Cuba, and that will make things easier. However, in terms of practicalities on the ground, there are relatively few Cuban hotels with Wi-Fi access. Almost all the hotels serving travelers do have internet access of some kind. But Cuba itself has been opening this year, beginning this year, has been opening public Wi-Fi zones for the first time, as they're now beginning to expand their broadband capacity. So it is very true when people say, well, Cuba, the Cuban government has wanted to control information. That is true. There's no doubt about it. But we have to remember that they've simply not been able to provide the broadband for permitting everybody to have internet access. And we're beginning now to see, as things ease between the USA and Cuba, that Cubans are finding it much easier to access internet because the government is making that possible.
Well, we are talking about traveling to Cuba with our guest, Christopher Baker. He's a travel journalist, has been to Cuba many, many times. He specializes in that country, has written books about it, including travel guidebooks for National Geographic Traveler. And again, if you want to join the conversation, if you've been thinking about going to Cuba, maybe you're on the fence, or maybe you even oppose this idea, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We have a tweet from Jay. He wants to know about gay life in Cuba. Can you speak to that, Christopher?
Yes, I can. The gays are out of the closet in Havana, certainly. And so things have eased up. There was certainly quite a bit of persecution of gays until recently, and it is very fortunate in the sense that Raul Castro's daughter, Mariela, is the head of the sex education center in Cuba. And she has made it her passion to promote equality, equal rights, and equal treatment of the gay, lesbian, transgender community. And so certainly the gays are out of the closet, and I would say fully accepted in Havana. It's a little different story when you go to the countryside, because the countryside is very much stepping back in time to a century ago in so many regards. And still, so I say that because there's still a lot of machismo. Certainly the state would not permit overt discrimination against gays in the countryside, but you don't find the same acceptance that you would in Havana. And there is certainly a very active gay life. There's no gay club per se that is permitted to be a gay club as such, but in reality there are venues that cater almost principally to gays.
Is there a Bay of Pigs museum in Cuba?
Great question. It's one of my favorite places, and in fact I'll be there next week.
Oh, great.
There is. The Bay of Pigs, it's called Giron in Cuba, has an excellent museum, and it maintains the hardware. You'll see aircraft and tanks, of course, from the battles that were fought at the Bay of Pigs. But most importantly, it gives a Cuban perspective on the events there. And I like going there. In fact, I'll be there next week. I'm leading a National Geographic Expeditions trip, and I give a 90-minute presentation on the bus as we go there, talking about the Bay of Pigs events and the Cuban Missile Crisis, because the Cuban Missile Crisis was a direct consequence of the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And in fact, of course, there is a Cuban Missile Crisis exhibition in Havana also.
How about, and can you go to, and I know you can't actually go to Guantanamo Bay, but just, you know, how does that fit on this island?
Well, it's fascinating. Let's just explain to people why we're at Guantanamo. You may recall that the Spanish-American War, which ended in 1898, ended up with Cuba coming under U.S. military administration for 4 years. At the end of that, Washington wrote the Constitution for Cuba and granted Cuba its independence. We forgot to give ourselves Guantanamo Bay, and so a year later, we amended an independent nation's constitution, because we had the power to do it, and wrote ourselves the lease for Guantanamo, which is indefinite lease. We pay a lease fee, $4,085, that the Cuban government does not cash every year, a treasury check. So Guantanamo Bay is occupied because we granted it to ourselves. That said, the city of Guantanamo is a colonial city, a heavily militarized presence, of course, because it's a Cuban defensive zone. And now the Cubans themselves have opened up a restaurant on the hilltop with a lookout over the U.S. naval base outside Guantanamo itself. And so that's what why we have Guantanamo. Of course, you cannot access the base. It is surrounded by a Cuban military zone, which obviously you can't enter either.
But you can have a lovely meal and look at it, right?
You can, indeed.
Let me get
From that lookout, by the way, which opened just about 18 months ago, you're looking down on the Soviet tanks, the Cuban tanks, but they're Soviet-made, that are doing their training on the training ground there in the defensive zone. It's quite fascinating.
I bet. Let me get Monica from Wayne to join us. Hi, Monica. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for the program.
You're welcome.
I visited Cuba in 2011. So I visited as a part of an educational exchange. I went with my mother and aunt, who are retired school teachers. And it was really eye-opening. Two highlights for you and the audience: education and then the slave intake. So one of the first stops we made on this visit was to an educational center that documented the educational initiative right after the revolution in the 50s to educate poor people, literally peasants, who had never been exposed to any kind of schooling. And that was transformational to the country, something we actually observed when later we went to a hospital and you saw the, literally people who were descendants of slaves as doctors. And then the slave intake center we visited, I think, on the last day of full day there. It was really impactful. Several folks cried because the takeaway we had is that Cuba was one of those ports where slaves were sort of lined up and eeny, meeny, miny, mo sent to other islands and other parts of the New World. So we really drove home the message that, all of us could be family of Cubans. So it was a really powerful visit, and I encourage people to go.
Well, Monica, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Christopher, anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I do. And I'm glad you've raised that because, for my mind, the reason you visit Cuba is not to visit it in its 1950s time warp, et cetera, but it's to really understand and appreciate, in a sense, a place that is so very, very different from ours. The value systems are very different in so many ways. And she's raised a critically important point. She was speaking about the Cuban literacy campaign where they eradicated illiteracy. So Cuba is the only country in the Western Hemisphere with 100% literacy. And this is one area where they've done an absolutely magnificent job. My Cuban girlfriend came up through the special school system where she's trained as a musician. She's a professional violinist. And she comes from the most humble of backgrounds, the most humble living conditions. And before the revolution, we're talking now United Nations and World Bank statistics, somewhere around 40% of Cubans had no access to education whatsoever. They were illiterate. And so we have to look to the accomplishments. The state has done a marvelous job in that field. I'm a little more ambivalent in speaking about health. I've seen the good and the bad, but at least everybody in Cuba has access to free health, something as a coming from England, I firmly believe in. And so that's another story entirely.
Well, we're almost out of time here. A Facebook comment from Debbie says, we're going on the first cruise to Cuba from the U.S. in May using Fathom Cruise Lines as the people-to-people requirement. So you can confirm that we will be able to walk around and explore on our own without a minder, as was mentioned when talking about journalists. Can you just go and explore?
There's no such thing as a Cuban minder. As a journalist, when I used to go as a journalist, of course, I may have been followed, and in fact, I know that was the case. But your average tourist is not. They can go wherever they want. There's no such thing as a minder. You will, on Fathom, I know Fathom very well. I'm talking with Tara, the president. They are going under the people-to-people license, and that does mean that you're not supposed to be freely roaming as an individual wherever you want to go. You do have to follow that 9-to-5 criteria of having people-to-people engagements. It can be on the street, it can be on the plaza, and you'll only be minded, if that's the right word, in the sense that you will ideally be escorted for much of the time walking around by your Cuban guides, and we're not talking minders, we're talking about guides who are there to educate you.
Well, Christopher Baker, we're going to end on that note. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Have a wonderful time in Cuba. I'm sure you will.
Well, thank you so much, Marty, for having me here. And my website, by the way, is ChristopherPBaker.com.
Very good. And this is Celia Cruz.
Cubana.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
La libertad fue un trofeo que nos conquistó el Mambí con el verbo de Martí y el machete.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. 3 years ago, Hurricane Sandy, also known as Superstorm Sandy, was battering the east coast of the United States. And when it was over, it left in its wake an estimated $50 billion worth of damage, from flooding, downed trees and power lines, and buildings, bridges, boardwalks ripped apart. An estimated 150 people died. What made Sandy so destructive were the powerful winds combined with sea level rise. Back in 2005, climate researcher Michael Oppenheimer and some of his colleagues wrote a paper about the effect of sea level rise on New Jersey. He's a professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University. WHYY's audio news director Eugene Son talked with Oppenheimer about his predictions of 10 years ago and whether they have come true.
Things are not good. The projections that we had for both Earth's temperature and sea level are progressing more or less as we'd expected. If anything, things are playing out a little faster than we would have thought 10 years ago. The major problem is that the two big ice sheets, the one in Antarctica and the one in Greenland, are losing ice to the ocean faster than we thought they were, and that's meant that sea level rise has been accelerating. So what we're predicting, and particularly the area around the northeast coast, is somewhat starker than we thought would happen.
So what are the most up-to-date projections?
For the world as a whole, sea level rise over this coming century could be anywhere between about 30 centimeters, which is about a foot, and 3 feet, about a meter. But unfortunately, the northeastern United States sits in what you might call a hotspot for sea level rise. Sea level rise is faster here as the world warms due to the behavior and the response of ocean currents. And that means that if you look at, say, New York City or the Jersey Shore, that the rates of sea level rise are faster than the global average. So for this area, one might expect a sea level rise coming out at about 1 or 2 feet by the year 2050, and something as big as 4 feet or more by 2100. And that has stark implications because for every foot of sea level rise in the vertical direction, about 100 feet horizontally gets eroded away or submerged. That is, that's the amount of typical amount of beach that disappears on a typical beach in this area for that kind of sea level rise. This is a process that's going on. The only way that it's been dealt with in certain areas is by very expensive replenishment, nourishment of the beaches with more and more sand. In certain areas, they've built jetties or seawalls. But each of these measures has a downside. If you build a jetty and you protect the beach in one place, you rob sand from another place, which the drift of the water down the coast would have taken the sand to, but now there's a jetty in the way. If you build a seawall, everything in front of the seawall erodes away very quickly due to wave action. So there are no good solutions in the long term except to slow the rate of sea level rise.
When you say there are no good solutions, meaning mechanical dunes or otherwise, they'll become ineffective in a matter of time?
I mean, if the world keeps warming and sea level keeps rising, this is a fight that the ocean is going to win because if at some point it gets too expensive. There are things that can be done, but they need to be planned way in advance, and they're quite costly. For instance, London has, or the UK has built what's called a surge barrier across the Thames. That's a feature which is like a big dam, but it's open most of the time. But if a big storm comes along and there's going to be a surge of water towards London, the protection is raised from the floor of the Thames, and there's a barrier for as long as the storm is in the neighborhood. You can do that, but the costs are in the tens of billions of dollars, and they take decades to build. So it's not clear that even those solutions, which are big and expensive but work to some extent, are feasible because we're sitting around just sort of daydreaming while the Earth is warming and the sea is rising.
In your report that from 10 years ago, you used Cape May as a kind of a case study. The geography around there, it's pretty flat. It goes, you know, the heart of Cape May is pretty close to the water. What do you think Cape May would look like in 2050 if these current trends continue? Are the Victorian B&Bs that we're used to seeing, are they going to be partially underwater?
Well, I haven't got the map in front of me, and Cape May is a very complicated terrain. There are a lot of human-made features like jetties which interfere with the flow of sand. But the one thing that's outstanding about that beach is it's very, very shallow in its slope. And the more shallow the slope of a beach is, the more sea level rise eats away at the land. So I think Cape May is extremely vulnerable, although again, I can't point to a house that I think is going to be gone and point to a date at which it will be gone. The other thing that should be mentioned is that we're talking mostly about the constant trend of sea level rise, which is trouble enough. But in fact, of course, we mostly experience the effect of the sea level during intense coastal storms. What happens is when there's a big storm, it pulls the ocean surface up. That's called the storm surge. And the winds push that storm surge into the coastal area, that is, push it onto the land. So if a storm, for instance, like Hurricane Sandy, had come along 100 years ago, it would have caused significantly less damage than Sandy did when it came along in 2012, because the sea is a foot higher, and that means that storm surge, which itself is about 9 feet, coupled, in this case at least, coupled to the foot or so of sea level rise we've had since the beginning of the century, means that the surge got further inland than it would have otherwise, destroying more houses, making life miserable, and disrupting it for many more people.
You and some colleagues have a new article recently published in the journal Nature Climate Change. And it talked about the storms we've seen since Sandy and Sandy itself and how that relates in terms of how often we expect storms of a certain size and how that relates to climate change, rising and warming oceans, et cetera. Could you explain some of that difference in terms of what might have been a 100-year storm before and how often we would see something like that now?
What sea level rise does is it makes the a given height of flood more frequent because it just adds an amount of water on top of what used to happen at a certain with a certain storm. So even if the storms don't get more serious, sea level rise means the same storm coming at, you know, coming today as came 100 years ago would cause flood levels to be higher. So for instance, a flood that 100 years ago would have been the 100-year flood, say, and would have been about 8 feet. Now that same storm will cause a 9-foot flood, and that flood maybe only came by every 200 years. So what we're doing by raising sea levels inadvertently is making a certain level of flood happen more and more frequently. A 500-year flood might happen now. The 500-year flood from a century ago might happen now every 300 years. The 100-year flood from a century ago might happen every 20 or 30 years. And going into the future, the current 100-year flood by the end of the century might happen every year. And a flood like Sandy's might happen every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we barely recovered from Sandy, and it's already 3 years out. So that means we're going to be taking these serious punches much more often, even if the storms don't get more intense. And some of the science suggests that hurricanes are going to get more intense. So we've got a combined sort of the 800-pound gorilla is coming at us. There's two of them, sea level rise and the strength of storms, and we can barely handle even what the risk we have today.
I'm imagining a listener to our station who, you know, maybe inherited a family house down the shore, thinking like, well, you know, maybe it's time to sell. Maybe, you know, maybe in the not too distant future, it's not something that I'm going to be able to protect.
So let's step through what one does about this problem. I don't want to just cast a lot of gloom. There are things we can if we act sensibly and if we act quickly. Number one is, we need to reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that ultimately are the cause of sea level rise. But while that will assure that quite a ways into the future that the sea level eventually stabilizes, there's still, no matter what we do, going to be a fairly substantial amount of sea level rise between now and that time, you know, in later in this century or beyond, when the sea level stops rising. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, the first thing we should do is identify vulnerable areas. And some of these areas should really just be left alone. They should be left to their natural condition, or if their natural condition has been disturbed, the nature should be allowed to, so to speak, regrow. In particular, wetlands are very effective at defending against storms because they eat up the energy of the storm before it gets too far inland. Number two, there are certain types of protection, particularly in urban areas, which need to be implemented, which are temporary, which don't destroy or change anything permanently, but can really help during a storm. So, for instance, in an urban area, there are a lot of buildings that have basements which flood. That's the first place water goes. We need to be better at taking emergency equipment or things that you need to live from day to day, like boilers, out of the basements, finding another place in densely populated areas like apartment buildings to put the emergency equipment or to put the necessary life support systems, essentially, so that they're not so much in harm's way. And to the extent they are, we need to seal them off if you can't get them out of the basements to protect the areas. Number three, and really critically important, we have to have better evacuation planning. There have to be warning systems that are improved. We have to find ways to go back into neighborhoods and make sure people actually do evacuate when the government suggests they evacuate. There has to be a reasonable shelter for them to go to. All of that is doable. It's not all that expensive compared to building seawalls or surge barriers, but it saves lives.
After Sandy, there was a boom in jacking up private homes and moving them up a story. In fact, a lot of insurance companies, I think, more or less demanded it. If you're going to rebuild, you have to elevate. Are there places where that kind of solution has been in place long enough that we can see how they hold up? Do they actually work in the long term? Or because it's a big investment on a homeowner's point of view. Often it can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm curious whether we know whether they really work in the long run.
They work up to a point. It depends on how, you know, if you want to build a home on stilts, what the stilts are made of, whether they're, you know, wood or concrete, and how deeply they're buried. It, with enough money, you can build something that'll stand up in the middle of the ocean after all. We see that. There are all kinds of structures that withstand the wind and the waves. There's a new theory that if certain parts of certain buildings, as has been done in the Netherlands, for instance, should just be floodable. So if there's a storm that comes around every 5 or 10 years, it's going to flood it. That's fine. You have stuff in the at the flood level which can tolerate a flood. There are various ways that this can be done. None of it is free, but it's a lot cheaper if we think about it in advance. And the worst thing is just throw up our hands and think we can continue doing business the way we've been doing it. We simply can't.
And I don't even know if this is possible, but if carbon dioxide levels were to plateau or even potentially recede in the long run, is it possible that sea levels could fall after being rising for so long?
Regrettably, sea level rise is one of several components of the climate system that has lagged behavior. That is, long after you start controlling the problem, you might eventually see a response. And the reason this happens is for several reasons, but one of the prime ones is that the ice sheets, which are now supplying about a third of the sea level rise, are so big and have so much inertia in them. That is, once they start to absorb heat and they start to change, they're so big that it's hard then to change their course again in the other direction. It's like trying to swing a super tanker around. That once we engage the ice sheets in sort of irreversible losses, it's just not going to be possible to turn the ship around. And so really bringing the sea level rise problem under control means two things. It means acting fast and seriously so that we don't get to the irreversible point with too much of either ice sheet. And still then, before the situation actually stabilizes, you're really talking several centuries down the line. So we can slow sea level rise. We can make a big dent in it by staying on a low emissions pathway. But we can't really reverse it for a long, long time.
Michael Oppenheimer, climate researcher at Princeton University, thank you so much for being our guest on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And that's WHYY's audio news director, Eugene Son, talking with Michael Oppenheimer. 3 years after Sandy, there has been some progress on the cleanup and recovery in New Jersey, but there are still storm victims waiting to get back into their homes. For more information on this, go to Newsworks at WHYY, and you can head on over to their New Jersey site. As you know, it's Halloween on Saturday, and to get you in the mood, here's a cut from Dracula's greatest hits.
You something you may not understand, but I'm a thirsty vampire. I want to bite your hand. You, I want to bite your hand. I want to bite your hand. Oh, please, please don't scream. I know you think it's grand. When I fly in your window, just let me bite your hand. Just let me bite your hand. I want to bite your hand. And when I bite you, I feel happy inside. It's so delicious that my thirst I can't hide.